Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark LeBonier. Coming up in this hour, True History, later on the Encore Theater from 1946. But first, it's American Adventure, bringing us the story behind the famous Zenger trial. This NBC episode from December 1st, 1955.
American Adventure. The University of North Carolina presents American Adventure. Written by John Ely, directed by John Clayton, American Adventure is produced and recorded by the Communications Center of the University of North Carolina. Earl Wynn, director. There are those who will tell you that the trial of John Zenger was a simple matter concerning freedom of the press. It was no simple matter, not in its day. Not when we leave out 20th century vantage point and go to the New York City of 1734, when there was a brush field just east of the present Broadway where quail were killed in autumn. The New York City of 10,000 people, of whom 1,700 were Negro slaves. A place of small shops and stores. A village place. We will take you there and seek out the story. Going now to two lawyers who hurry along a dirt street. Rushing along, for they have heard that the printer, John Zenger, has been arrested by the British governor. And Zenger is a friend.
I'll get the door. We came as soon as we heard, Mrs. Zenger.
They took John away.
Just tell us exactly what happened, Mrs. Zenger. We'll do all we can. We'll be sure of it.
Perhaps you've done enough already. It was you that got my husband in jail, Mr. Alexander. You and Mr. Morris and Mr. Morris Jr. and you, Mr. Smith. I and Mr. Colden. With your talk of freedom.
Now, Mrs. Zenger.
Any of the times I've been at the door when you and John were in here talking, you'd say the price of freedom is high, John. And he'd say, yes, and worth the price. But you never told him it would all lead to this.
Your husband knew the danger of opposing the governor, Mrs. Zenger. It's the same danger here as it was in Europe. There's no law involved. Governor Gosby cares nothing for the law.
Don't get her more excited, Alexander.
Your husband wasn't arrested with grand jury indictment. He will not be granted fair bail. He will be tried in a special court which has no precedent or authorization, and by a judge without a legal commission, and by a well-intimidated jury. You call that law? It isn't a question of law, do you understand?
Get hold of your temper, Alexander. This
is one of those cases where we must do what Andrew Hamilton was great at doing before he retired. Argue the law until you've lost that to the decision of the court. And then go over and put your foot on the low rail at the jury box and talk to them. I never was able to do that. A Scotsman can't hold his temper in an English court anyway.
They say you're the best in New York province, Mr. Alexander.
Well, I'll try, as you know well enough. I'll try desperately. And let's face the simple fact that there is no law to be used to our advantage in this case. Those who will interpret the law are on the other side and are as desperate as we. And they also believe they are right, just as much as we do. They wouldn't permit Smith or me to see or send word to John's cell. We finally obtained a court order which permitted his wife and servants to visit him. His bail was set at 10 times his value, more than was fair and more than John would permit anybody to lend him. So he remained in jail. In every way he could, the governor reminded us that we occupied a dangerous position.
Oh, I know you expected to gain public approval of your continual challenging of this court, Mr. Alexander. But
I have entered an exception as to your commission, Your Honor. And if that commission is in order...
You have forced us into a position where we must sacrifice the court or your services to the court. And so, both you and Mr. Smith are deprived of further opportunity to plead before the King's justice.
And what is the King's justice? Is it here where counsel for the defense is disbarred because counsel is serving the cause of the defendant? Are we to come in America to the Star Chamber that held England in...
Clerk will notify Mr. Zenger that he is without counsel. I appoint young Mr. Sawyer to defend him at request of defendant. Come in, Alexander. I've been expecting you.
I thought I would find you here, hanging up your wig, putting your law books in their proper order, taking off your robe. Then you'll go home, won't you, Delancey? Greet your wife and say, well, it was a pleasant day today, for I had the pleasure of disbarring two lawyers, both of whom have devoted their lives to the law.
It was no pleasure at all, Alexander. I respect both you and Smith.
You've shown a poor way to show it.
Sit down, Alexander. Perhaps I can explain.
Explain your reasons for opposing the people.
I've taken no stand against the people. A man has no right under the law to criticize legal government.
Has a man the right to fair bail or to defense to counsel and to a fair trial?
I have perhaps taken drastic action in the Sanger case, but for a reason. His challenge to authority is a real danger to law and order. And if I have set aside some of Zenger's legal rights, it is because I must.
You drive me to disgust. Your kind think you were born with the right to rule. You think a king can come out of a woman's womb and cry like a prince, and so do no wrong, and do as he wishes. And what if the people have won some rights and privileges? Why, let them have the rights until it's time to deprive them of them. Well, God save such kings and king's men, I say.
Keep a civil tongue in your head.
I will, just as you keep the law in your court. And while I'm talking, let me tell you this, Delancey. Before there was government, there were people. Do you believe that?
Of course I believe the...
People made government. Government did not breathe into people one spark of life or one breath of courage. People came first. And the question before us is, if the people have the right to criticize government officials who exercise the people's power in the people's service and supposedly for the people's benefit.
I see. And so I've heard before.
Tell me, to whom is Governor Cosby responsible?
To the king, I should say.
God save the king. He's busy this afternoon. And to whom is the king responsible?
Well, not to this German printer, I assure you of that.
Why isn't the king responsible in any way to the people who gave him his power? By gift or theft, in either case, the people have grounds to demand an accounting for the use of it. And that's what John Zenger has demanded. And that's why he's in jail. And it's because the whole structure of your authority is at stake in this matter that you're so much afraid that even you will set aside law and fairness and your conscience. Isn't it, Delancey?
I've heard enough of your Scotch talk, Alexander.
Do you know why I came over to this country, Delancey?
I've heard said that the king had a great dislike for you.
That's but half the reason.
Oh? And what composed the rest of it?
I had a great dislike for him. And now, be damned, if you are planning to bring a star chamber over here. Delancey, America is man's big chance. There is a wide, wide ocean between us and the old way. And we're going to take this new world and start over, do you hear? This is the people's side of the Atlantic, and the people are going to govern it.
Since when have people known what is best for them?
Since when have kings cared what is best for them?
Will people decide a question on its merits, or will they take the easy way out?
They will do both. But they'll have their own best interests more at heart than the king's governors.
And as the first step towards this remarkable government, you advocate freedom for men who own presses to print as they will?
If they will, to print the truth.
And is it necessary that these printers be men of breeding, of education? May they have criminal records? Will it become to them a rich and lush business, this legal blackmail of public officials?
Oh, to be sure. There will be editors who will sell themselves for 30 pieces of silver, paid in pennies on a street corner, just as there are governors who will do the same, though at a bigger charge for the service and in a palace. But eventually, the people will decide between one editor and another, between truth and half-truth, between honesty and deceit.
And what possible background have the people for making such decisions?
Why, they have as good a background for it as somebody who was made a ruler because his father had a father who had a father who had a father who knew or was or killed a king.
I have heard of faith in the people, Alexander. But I have never been eye to eye with blinder faith than yours. Come over to the window here, and I'll give you my reasons for opposing you and John Zenger.
What are they?
They're people. And they're right out there on the streets of New York. Dutch, German, Belgians, French, Danes, English, Irish, Scotch, Italians, Spaniards, Negro slaves, preachers, grocers, illiterates, cowards, idiots, soldiers, rich men, paupers, prostitutes, thieves, Quakers, Jews, Lutherans. And down on the waterfront you'll find a murderer or two, I expect. And any number of people here can be bought for less than the proverbial 30 pieces of silver. You might start with half a crown. These are my facts out there. These people are my arguments. Some of them good, some bad, some likable, some unlikable. But I have passed that adolescent stage when I gloried in the words of your Andrew Hamilton and of you other Scotch lawyers. I have come to face the simple reality that faces the street outside my office. Are we to give the new world over to them? Why, I accept God by faith, for to ask proof is absurd by definition, but I do not have to take the people by faith. I see them, I know them, and I tell you I do not have faith in them as a body to govern wisely or well.
And so, you will sacrifice John Zenger to save the people from themselves.
If I must, yes, I will sacrifice my own life.
'Tis a noble motivation, Delancey. And I'm pleased to say I'll be around to see you fail at it.
You'll not plead in my courtroom, Alexander.
No, but the people will have a jury there. Good afternoon. I'll see you at the trial.
One moment, Alexander. What is your answer to my arguments? Why do you avoid debating with me on this score?
I'm not concerned with changing your views. I can see that that is a task to require more than an afternoon. It may take a lifetime. There are honest men who hold your view just as honest men hold mine. And so there always will be. Honest men on either side of this question on any issue that is raised. It is not your opinion that bothers me, but your tactics, my friend. And God help you and anybody in America who would deprive a citizen of his rights. As I walked home from Delancey's office, I realized that my whole body was trembling. My energy and confidence were spent. Now, as the people passed me, my mind was confused. Delancey's words worried me. This whole business of believing in people, it has its moments of doubt. Why, Mrs. Hunt, what in the world do you want with those cats?
Mr. Alexander, I don't know. But 8 months ago when they were kittens, you remember how playful they were? And I couldn't bring myself to part with one of them. So now I've got 7 cats.
That's more than enough, I should say.
Yes, and the worst part of it is there are others on the way. Would you like to have a grown cat, Mr. Alexander?
No, Mrs. Hunt, thank you. But my wife has has a cat.
Oh, how wonderful. Tell me, is it a female?
I took great care to obtain a male.
How smart you were, Mr. Alexander. How very smart you were. James says that the bakery is hardly taking in enough for all those cats and us, too. But still, are you sure you wouldn't want a cat?
If you'll excuse me, Mrs. Hunt, I'll be getting along.
Oh, of course. Oh, by the way, Mr. Alexander, how is Mr. Zenger?
He's thinner, due to the poor food, I understand, but well enough?
I'm worried about him, and so is James. James said last night that he might get put on the jury, and then it might all be lost.
What would be lost?
The bakery. You see, all the rich people buy cakes and pies and breads. Poor people bake their own. And if my husband gets on the jury and the jury finds Mr. Zenger innocent, well, you know what the governor's friends think about Mr. Zenger.
I suppose I understand what you're saying. But the jury is selected by chance, and I have nothing to do with it. Would you excuse me?
But I haven't told you about last night.
What about it?
We have our family prayers at night, you know. James and the children and myself. We pray each of us in our turn. And last night, when it came to me, I mentioned Mr. Zenger to the Lord. And I said, Lord, help John Zenger. And if it be thy will, put James on the jury. But only if it be thy will, Lord. In Jesus' name. And it's the custom at the prayers when a person finishes for the family to say amen. But there was a long pause, and then it was low, but I heard it, and the Lord must have heard it too. For James, he said amen. Then the children said amen, and it was done. And the Lord knows we're willing. I thought you'd like to know too, Mr. Alexander.
Yes. Yes, Mrs. Hunt. I'd like to know. Well, the story of John Zenger is well known, for it's taught in schools, which would have pleased him if he'd known. But for those of you who didn't care too much about school, I'll tell you how the trial turned out. We had a time finding a lawyer who was willing to defend John Zenger. You know, they had families and ambitions, or they were busy, or you know. So we went to Philadelphia, Smith and I, for our lawyer. We picked perhaps the best in the whole country, the retired Andrew Hamilton. An old man then, bothered with the ailment of age, but willing to return to practice for this precedent-setting case. The old Scotsman used my brief, I'm happy to say, but it did him little good, for Justice Delancey insisted on the rulings of the Star Chamber. So finally, Hamilton hobbled over to the jury box and began talking to the jury. Delancey grew extremely angry.
You may submit your evidence, Mr. Hamilton, and leave the interpretation of the law and the charge to the jury, to the court.
I know that I may, Your Honor. But I also know that I may not choose to do so. And now suppose, gentlemen of the jury, we talk about what's at stake in this case. Just the 13 of us. Let's decide how we in America want to interpret the laws about libel.
When the jury had been out for some time, I sneaked over and sat down beside Mrs. Hunt.
Why, good afternoon, Mr. Alexander.
Hello, Mrs. Hunt. Looks like your prayer was heard.
So it was. Well, if it was the Lord's will, then it'll be the Lord that will take care of us. And I do think John Zenger has a good chance of being found innocent after that fine speech in his favor.
It's going to be a difficult decision for a jury to make. They'll be criticized, perhaps chastised, if they find Zenger innocent, and the judge has already...
Oh, there they are, Mr. Alexander.
There's the jury coming in, you see.
It took them a long time enough to come to terms, didn't it?
Not so long. Your husband's at the front. He's the chairman, you know.
Looks so good standing there, doesn't he?
Hmm? Yes, I suppose so.
I always said James was the best-looking one of the Hunt boys. Only one that took after his father in looks. Better businessman than either of his brothers, too. Except maybe for today.
Prisoner will rise and face the jury.
And so John Zenger rose and faced his jury. The moment seemed to stop expectantly. Delancey leaned forward. The Attorney General ceased gathering up the notes of his case. Andrew Hamilton waited tensely, for experience gives little definite clue to the decision of the juries. John Zenger appeared to be calm, but I noticed that his hands were clenched. His wife was crying. The jurymen were looking straight ahead to a man, the Dutch and Irish and Englishmen, who were the 12 good men and true. The people in the courtroom were absolutely silent. And outside the courtroom, people were waiting. People throughout the province. People even in England were waiting. Some in hope, some in fear.
How does the jury find the defendant? Guilty or no?
No, not guilty.
And so with these words, it became possible for an American to criticize his government, and the baker lost his bakery. That afternoon, there was rejoicing in New York City. The guns in the harbor gave Andrew Hamilton a salute. And he and our party went to the Black Horse Tavern, the favorite spot in New York at the time. Even Mrs. Inger and John and the children were there, and we praised Hamilton and we praised each other. And then we asked for a toast from John Zinger himself. John rose slowly from his chair.
The governor says I'm a man of too many words. I am a man of one word, and she is freedom. From 9 months in prison, I give you freedom. From my years of life on this earth in the old country and my years here, I give you my goddess, and I tell you, honor her, and she will reward you as she has me. Honor her not, and she will leave you. Guard her, or she will be stolen. Worship her, or she will be taken from you. And then you will say, I want freedom back again, and you will go to find her. She is easily lost, and she is easily sought, but it is not easy to find her. My friends of America, I give you freedom.
American Adventure is written by John Ely, directed by John Clayton, produced by the Communication Center of the University of North Carolina. In the Zinger trial, Alexander was played by Earl Wynn, Mrs. Zinger by Gail Ely, Smith by Charles Kuralt, the English judge Delancey by John Ely, Mrs. Hunt by Joe Grushevsky, and John Zinger by John Bonnet. Carl Castle speaking. American Adventure is produced and recorded by the University of North Carolina on the campus at Chapel Hill.
Next Thursday night, NBC invites you to hear the story of Thomas Wolfe on American Adventure.
American Adventure on Tuned to Yesterday from December 1st, 1955 on NBC. The results of the Zinger trial was known as one of Alexander Hamilton's greatest triumphs in his career. Zinger, being the publisher of the New York Weekly Journal, would pass away in July of 1746, with his family carrying on the publishing duties of the paper for the next 3 years. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now a true story featured on the Encore Theater 6 years after the tale made it to the silver screen with Edward G. Robinson in the title role, called Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet, a CBS broadcast from July 23, 1946.
Shenley Laboratories, producer of penicillin Shenley and Shenley Pharmaceuticals, presents the Encore Theater. The Encore Theater play tonight, Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet. Our star is Charles Bickford. Tonight, Shenley Laboratories presents another in a new series of great dramatic programs. Some of our stories are fact, the struggles and accomplishments of great men of medicine. Others are fiction, stories of devotion to an ideal, individual heroism, or great courage.
By these programs, Shenley Laboratories would remind you that medical science and progress is not cold, impersonal research or pages of statistics, but a warm human story told in living terms, whether it's the life of one of medicine's immortals or the everyday record of service rendered by your own physician. And now, Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet, starring Charles Bickford as Dr. Ehrlich.
The facts are history now. The words have been recorded for all to read. The man has been set in his rightful spot of honor among those designated by science and medicine for immortality. Listen to his story. The story of a man against a microbe. Let us go back to his younger years when he was working in the Kaiser Wilhelm Hospital in Berlin. A man with a poor, undernourished body, sustained and driven by inner fires. In those days, he was not thought much of, and his laboratory experiments were ridiculed. But he became friendly with another young doctor, and through him, he received a most important invitation.
Dr. Baring, I can't tell you how...
Dr. Ehrlich, I'm delighted to see you. Professor Koch has called this meeting to announce a most exciting discovery.
Very kind of you to ask me.
Oh, some very important men are here today. There's Altoff over there, the Minister of Science. No, over there, the one with the mutton chop whiskers. Come on, we'd better sit down. Here comes Professor Koch onto the platform now.
Gentlemen, it has long been my belief that tuberculosis is caused by a living microbe. Today, I am able to announce that the search for this microbe has come to a successful conclusion. I have discovered the cause of tuberculosis in the corpse of persons suffering from this disease. It is a living germ with a long, rod-like shape. I invite you all to come forward and view a specimen of it under the microscope. Unfortunately, the bacilli do not stand out clearly. Only those whose eyes are trained in the use of the microscope will be able to see them. That, of course, makes my discovery of little or no value to the average doctor in diagnosing causes of tuberculosis.
It might be possible to see the bacilli by staining it.
Ehrlich! What's that? Who spoke?
It was I, Herr Professor.
What did you say? Come down front, please. I can't hear you.
Yes, sir.
Did you say stain the bacilli?
Yes, sir. We must compound a dye which will combine with the substance of this microbe. Then the microbe will be plainly seen, for it and nothing else on the slide will be stained.
Did you ever stain a microbe and nothing else on a slide?
Well, no, as a matter of fact, but I have reason to believe it's possible.
If it is possible, I advise you to do so. Your fame in science will be guaranteed.
May I have a culture?
By all means, but be careful of the contents of this tube, young man. They're very dangerous.
Thank you, Dr. Koch.
Yes, good luck, young man. You'll need it.
Oh, Paul, that cough has me worried.
Oh, I'm all right, Hetty. Stop acting so much like a wife. You were saying, Emil?
You've been working on those slides for months without getting anywhere, Paul. Maybe you should give up. Perhaps your theory is wrong.
Don't say that, Emil. I know my theory's right.
All that cold.
It's too cold for you in your laboratory. I made a fire.
What? Did you say you lit a fire?
Why, yes, Paul.
Oh, no.
What? Well, what's the matter, Paul?
You've ruined my slides, that's what. I've told you to stay out of here. I've told you a dozen times.
I'm sorry, Paul. Please forgive me.
Look at them. A week's work gone for nothing.
Give me that towel, Hetty. We'll get them off the stove. Maybe they won't be spoiled.
Yeah, put them here on the table. We'll look at them, but I haven't much hope. Amy. Look. The microbe. It's stained. The heat must have fixed the dye. Do you see them, Emil?
Of course I see them. The red rod-like shapes are the tubercle bacilli. Anyone can see them now. Oh, this is marvelous, Paul, marvelous.
My dear, dear Mrs. Ehrlich, will you marry me?
My darling Dr. Ehrlich, of course I will.
There you are, Professor Koch.
My microbe, a bright red. My dear Ehrlich,
How did you do it?
By applying fuchsin red, heating the slide, then washing it with alcohol. It's the heat that does the trick.
This is a great contribution. The doctors, little doctors everywhere, will be able to diagnose tuberculosis with 100% accuracy. I owe you an apology, Dr. Ehrlich, for my attitude toward you at the meeting.
Why, you make me very happy, Professor Cope.
Dr. Ehrlich, I want you to join my staff. What I said in irony holds good. Your place in science is guaranteed.
Against the microbe. It was the beginning of the fight for him, and he would still be fighting when he died. They sent him to Egypt before they let him work to get rid of his cough. And while he was there, he began to study the effects of snake bites on people. And he began to wonder why snake bites were fatal in some cases and not in others. So when he came back...
This is your laboratory, Dr. Ehrlich. I hope you find it satisfactory. Now you can go ahead developing new staining methods.
I'm very grateful. But with your indulgence, I'd rather not work on dyes at present.
Oh, indeed? Well, in that case, you might join your friend Dr. Baring in his diphtheria experiments. The number of new cases is alarming, most alarming. It looks as if we're in for an epidemic.
I'm afraid diphtheria is not what I'm looking for either.
Well, then what in heaven do you want to do?
Right now, I want to work on snakes.
Ehrlich, I laughed at you before, and I was wrong. If it's snakes you want, very well. You shall have snakes.
Get three more snakes and prepare them for me to collect the venom. These are depleted.
Yes, Dr. Emil.
Hello, Emil. What luck?
Oh, every child I tried the diphtheria serum on died. It didn't work at all. I can't figure it out, Paul. With the guinea pigs, it worked perfectly.
Forgive me, Emil, but I'm in the midst of an experiment. Another time, I'll be glad to listen.
Another time? Perhaps all the children in Germany will have choked to death by then. But of course, your own experiment must come first.
Amy, listen to me. You don't know what you're talking about. When I was in Egypt, a man and a boy were bitten by an adder, the same snake. The boy died horribly, but the man wasn't even made sick.
I'm only interested in diphtheria.
Please, Amy, here's the point. Three times before he'd been bitten. Three times. Each time, the venom had less effect. The symptoms became less and less severe. This last time, he wasn't even sick.
Immune, huh?
For weeks now, I've done the same thing experimentally. Infecting animals with gradually larger doses of snake venom until they were getting shots that would ordinarily kill 100 of their species.
Go on.
All of which proves that immunity is not a quality of the blood, but something in the blood. Specific substances that are formed by the cells. A chemical army which destroys bacteria and poisons.
Ah, I'm beginning to see what you're getting at.
Look. This graph represents the development of immunity to snake venom. It shows how you can increase the quantity of antibodies to neutralize any given amount of poison.
Yes, yes. Do you think in diphtheria...
Why not? We have only to store a sufficient quantity of antibodies in an animal by injecting it. Not once, but 10, 20, 30 times.
You mean that the blood of a horse, perhaps which had withstood 20 increasingly large doses of diphtheria toxin, would cure a child?
That's my theory.
Paul. Paul, I want to beg your pardon.
Emil... There's never any need for apologies between friends. Friends become friends because they understand one another. Here, let's get to work.
There's no use bringing any more children to this hospital. We can't do anything for them. They might as well die at home.
I have given orders to put up beds in the corridors, in the offices. We can't let them die in the streets. Come in. Dr. Ehrlich. Dr. Baring. What are you doing here?
We have a new serum we're going to try. We were sent over by Professor Koch at the specific urging of Minister Althoff.
Baring, what's the use? You tried your serum several times before, and it failed.
In the laboratory, this new serum showed itself 100 times as effective as the old.
Baring's old serum was good in the laboratory, too.
Nothing can stop the epidemic unless it is this serum. You cannot ignore the possibility.
You are right, Dr. Ehrlich. We cannot ignore any possibility. We will give the serum a last and final test. I will give you a ward with 40 diphtheria patients in it. You will give the serum to 20 patients and withhold it from the rest. If there is a higher percentage of recovery among the patients treated than among the untreated ones, we will know the serum has some value.
As long as there's a chance the serum may work, I think we should give it to everybody.
Only with a controlled experiment can we establish the value of your serum once and for all. So remember, 20 get the serum, and 20 do without.
Alcohol. New needle. Too much. Check again. Another syringe. All right, prepare this boy.
Paul, he would make 21.
Look at his eyes. Did you deny him a chance to live?
No, but Hartman said...
I'm going to inject them all. Are you with me?
I'm with you, Paul.
Ehrlich had a bitter quarrel with Hartmann after they'd finished the injections. And he and Baring left the hospital with the knowledge that if their serum failed, there would be objects of ridicule. They went to Ehrlich's small house and began to pace the hours until they should hear. And at last, an orderly came with the ominous message that His Excellency Minister Althoff was waiting to see them at the hospital.
Since when do young research men ignore the instructions of distinguished physicians? In all my experience, I have never heard of such a thing.
I was wrong, Your Excellency, I know. But if you could have seen the faces of these children as they fought for breath...
And if you had known that there was even a chance they might be saved...
You may consider yourselves very fortunate indeed that things turned out as they did.
Why, Your Excellency?
Is there news from the diphtheria ward?
Is it possible that you haven't heard?
Heard? What?
Every one of the children you injected is recovering. The antitoxin saved them. I am issuing orders that batches of the serum be made up and sent to every city in Germany. Gentlemen, have a cigar.
Paul, I think I'd better sit down.
I'm going to see that both of you young men get the recognition you deserve. Dr. Ehrlich, for you I'm going to create a research laboratory where you can be your own master. What do you say?
Well, there is an idea, a theory that I want to experiment on.
A theory?
Yes. I believe it will be possible one day to manufacture immunity to disease in a test tube. Mold little magic bullets to shoot into the bloodstream and destroy invading microbes.
And what disease are you specifically going after with this magic bullet?
Syphilis.
Ten years of study, experiment, experiment. Study. 10 years.
Gentlemen, we have two factors to reckon with. The poisonous effect on the cells of the microbe, which of course would affect a cure, and the poisonous effect on the cells of the body, which would be fatal to the patient. Each shall be represented by a line on this chart. The further apart we can push these two lines, the closer we shall be to success. When they are the width of this chart apart, we shall have found the magic bullet. May take heaven knows how...
10 years of concentration and labor, of disappointment and progress. 10 years, at the end of which Baring, now a distinguished professor, came to see him. And an old friendship seemed lost, for Baring and Ehrlich found themselves strangers.
Paul, I have come here at Minister Althoff's request. He's been having difficulty with the budget committee. They don't want to grant your appropriation. Althoff has asked me to express an opinion as to the value of your work. He believes it would have sufficient weight to overbalance the opposition.
Well?
Well, it places me in a very unpleasant position. The idea of shooting chemicals into the veins of human beings fills me with horror. If you were not my friend, I would attack it publicly.
I'm not asking you to be silent. Put it in writing so that one day I can wave it before your nose. No. No use doing that, because you can't see beyond your nose.
I'm sure you know how much our friendship means to me.
No. We were friends 10 years ago when your mind was open to new ideas. But we could never be friends with your present attitude.
Good day, Paul.
Goodbye, Emil.
Baring went back with his unfavorable report. And Ehrlich's funds were cut in half. But funds were secured for him from private sources. and the work went on.
Gentlemen, we have discovered beyond any shadow of doubt that arsenic is the key that fits the molecules to which the microbe is composed. But it also fits the molecules of which the brain and nerves are composed. We must now shape our key so that it fits only the microbe.
The days became weeks, the weeks months, and the numbers on his great chart representing experiments mounted into the hundreds. And gradually, the lines grew farther and farther until the numbers on the chart reached 606, and the lines were the width of the chart apart.
Dr. Ehrlich, the board of directors of the German Medical Association, has delegated us to ask you when you will submit your drug for recommendation. You must realize, Dr. Ehrlich, that every physician throughout the world is eager to use your new specific.
No, gentlemen. I'm sorry, but I cannot release the specific at this time. First, I must find out how the preparation affects people with complications, with diseases, with high blood pressure, with nervous conditions. You must give me more time, gentlemen.
I have a patient, a young girl. It would be a tragedy if she should die of this horrible thing. With 606, her life can be saved. I'm an old man, Dr. Ehrlich, and you will forgive me if I speak freely. I recall that some years ago there was a diphtheria epidemic and a young doctor, unknown, and transcended the scientific attitude to relieve some suffering children. If there is a remedy in the name of humanity, surely that doctor will release it to the public.
There is nothing I can say in answer to so eloquent a plea, Doctor. I will see that you gentlemen get the specific as you require it.
It was the gesture of the humanitarian, not the wise, emotionless decision of the man of science. And he was in trouble very fast.
In how many deaths, Wolfert, do you have absolute proof that Ehrlich's compound was the cause?
38.
As publisher of the most influential newspapers in the country, it is your duty to reveal the truth about this damnable drug.
I have here an article of my own writing which will serve to launch the attack. I'll read you part of it. The victims of 606 were as surely murdered as if they had been stabbed from behind. How can such a dangerous drug be distributed in enormous quantities in our country? The reason is that its discoverer, Paul Ehrlich, and the Rhine Chemical Industries Incorporated, through their influence with persons in high station, have been able to put pressure on physicians, health officers.
If we publish that, Ehrlich will sue you for libel.
I wouldn't ask anything better. A trial would bring everything into the open. It would be the finish of Ehrlich and his so-called specific. One of the biggest names of science would testify in our behalf. Emil von Behring himself.
Before resuming, the court must once more remind all parties concerned that this is a trial of libel, and that the sole question which concerns us at this time is, did Dr. Ehrlich distribute a poisonous product which caused the deaths of numerous individuals, and did he continue to market the product for personal profit after he had knowledge of these deaths, as stated by the defendant, Dr. Wolfert, in his article? The defense attorney will continue, please.
Dr. Lynch, you have heard previous witnesses in this case testify to the deaths of 38 persons. Were the symptoms in all these instances precisely similar to those of your patient, Frieda Metzger?
Yes.
And in your opinion, what was the cause of Frieda Metzger's death?
Arsenic poisoning.
Your Honor, of course arsenic is a poison. There can be no question but that arsenic killed him.
I object. Dr. Ehrlich is injuring himself through testifying without legal advice.
I want no legal advice. It's a question of truth. To a great extent, I am responsible for these deaths. It would not have occurred had I withheld 606 until I was able to test every reaction to the drug. These fatalities, however, have taught us that in certain rare instances, a chemistry occurs within the body which breaks down the compound and releases the arsenic. And now we know also that each of these individuals flies a danger flag,
an intense itching of the skin, which manifests itself in ample time to discontinue treatment. In the future, the preparation may be prescribed to any sufferer without risk.
Your Honor, we are not concerned with the rosy future which Dr. Ehrlich paints. The relevant point is his admission that 606 caused the deaths of 38 people.
I am only trying to help the court understand the real nature of these deaths.
The court understands well enough without your assistance.
I demand that the counsel for the defense show respect toward my client.
Gentlemen, gentlemen! I'm afraid that your observations are irrelevant to this issue, Dr. Ehrlich.
Irrelevant.
Next witness,
Paul Nettle, who audits the books of the Ehrlich Institute.
Mr. Mantle, is there a special fund devoted to further work on 606?
Yes. It operates on the sums I receive from the Rhine Chemical Industries Incorporated.
Does Dr. Ehrlich take money from this fund for his personal use at any time?
No, that would be impossible. It is a trust fund which can be used only for test animals, laboratory equipment, and four salaried assistants.
Your Honor.
Yes, Dr. Wolford?
In view of this testimony, I feel called upon to make a public apology to Dr. Ehrlich for accusing him of capitalizing on his specific. It must be remembered, however, that the main issue is in no way affected by the present revelation. My original statement that 606 is a poison and not a cure remains unchanged. I'm sure that Professor von Behring will corroborate this statement.
Will Professor Emil von Behring take the stand, please? Professor Behring, is there any scientific means of proof by which it is possible to determine whether or not 606 performs lasting cures?
Only time, which tries all truth.
In your opinion, were the 38 deaths mentioned in the evidence here due to 606?
In my opinion, they were.
So that while no cures can be attributed to 606, 38 deaths resulted from its use.
39.
39? You know of another?
Yes. Syphilis.
But, Herr Professor, you have written and lectured against the Ehrlich theory of chemical therapy.
Dr. Wolfert must realize that it is the task of science to discover the truth, and that there is no shame attached to recognition of error. In the past 6 months, I have studied hundreds of cases, and I am now convinced that 606 is a complete success. 606 stops infectiousness. The individuals who are treated with it are no longer capable of passing on the disease to others. And if there is no transmission of the infection, the disease must necessarily die out. True, 38 individuals are dead from 606. But those dead must be thought of as martyrs to the public good. If 10 times their number had fallen, I would still say it is all for the best. For through it, and only through 606, or possibly some new drug not yet discovered, can the fight against this dread disease be won.
The court is satisfied from the evidence that 606 is recognized by the medical profession as the best remedy yet developed for syphilis. And it is the court's hope that this trial will not only serve to vindicate Dr. Ehrlich of the accusations made by the defendant, but also that it will impress upon the world the full value of his great contribution to mankind. Therefore, in accordance with paragraph 186 of the code, the defendant, Dr. Hans Wolfert, stands convicted of criminal libel and is sentenced to 1 year in prison. In view of the fact that he's not previously been convicted of any crime, the prison sentence will be suspended and he'll be placed on probation.
I don't know what to say to you, how to thank you for your testimony.
Don't thank me, Paul. For the rest of my life, I'm going to be thanking you. And so will all doctors and all people. Not only in our time, but in all the times to come. You're an honor to your profession, your country, and your century.
Here is the star of tonight's play, Charles Bickford.
Ladies and gentlemen, to sum up the spirit of this Shenley Laboratories program, this simple and beautiful prayer of the physician, written centuries ago by Maimonides, seems to me to be apt and fitting. The eternal providence has appointed me to watch over the life and death of all thy creatures. May I always see in the patient a fellow creature in pain. Grant me strength and opportunity always to extend the domain of my craft. This is the prayer of the physician. It is ages old, yet today it is as new as the hope for a peaceful way of life for all the world. May we invite you to listen again next week at this same time when Shenley Laboratories presents Dark Victory, starring Franchot Tone and Susan Peters. Two great stars in a great story. Good night.
Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet was produced and directed by Bill Lawrence and was presented through the courtesy of Warner Brothers, who this year is celebrating the 20th anniversary of Sound Pictures. It was a Gene Holloway adaptation. Charles Bickford will soon be seen in the Dorry Sherry RKO production, Katie for Congress. This is Frank Graham speaking for Shenley Laboratories, producer of Penicillin Shenley, and inviting you to listen next Tuesday at the same time when you will hear Franchot Tone and Susan Peters in Dark Victory. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Encore Theater, untuned to yesterday from the 23rd of July, 1946 on CBS. And so closes this hour of True History, untuned to yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.